Good evening. I think we should start so that, as you were here, even though I wasn't on time, that I don't make things even later. My name is Peter Lims. I'm a visiting associate professor on the Ecom-Icom program. Oops, use that in case my voice isn't loud enough. Okay. I'm from Denmark. I have a background in broadcasting and new media, and I'm teaching a module on business model development. There's several of the victims on the course actually in the room. So, I would like to talk about apps and something which is maybe I'm not completely familiar to you, or the whole business of second screen apps. And so that's why I've chosen the title, Designing Second Screen Apps, What's Hot and What's Not. But the lineup for this evening, and I'll try and speak for about 40 minutes so there's enough time for questions. Put it in a context. What are we talking about when we talk about media? And then go on to look at what do we mean by an app, the whole business of social media and social communication, what do we mean by screens in this context, and what's the current situation in terms of the developments. And then moving on to look at how do we actually do some of these things, and briefly some views on the design process of digital media, but also what's actually going on these days when it comes to research which is applied to the development of things of that kind. And then to round off some perspectives of what we can expect in the not too distant future in this particular area. If we think about media in the 20th century, and that's not all that long ago, but we saw the emergence of electronic media in the 20th century. Media like, first of all, we had cinema, then we had radio, then television. And towards the end of the century, we got the internet and mobile technologies. But for people like my mother, many of these developments were rather worrying. It was a question of, for her, who she was used to old technologies, television in particular, radio. She used the phone, didn't really use a mobile, and she never got around to using a PC. But that was her world. But if we look at the world of my grandkids, for example, that's a rather different one. They're not analog natives. They're digital natives. They've actually grown up in a world which is increasingly or almost exclusively digital. So the two boys and the two girls are quite adept at looking and accessing content. Even Oliver there, who's 18 months old, can actually select things on an iPad, to my amazement and horror. So in their world, certainly in Denmark, they're more likely to be talking about things like YouTube and Netflix. Perhaps when they're a bit older, things like Xbox. Certainly things like Spotify and music services. Smartphones and iPads and perhaps laptops and tablets. So that's their world. So they're digital natives. But I think most of us in the room, with a few young exceptions, could actually be regarded as digital immigrants. We weren't born in a digital world, but we've had to migrate into that world. In my case, I grew up with things like magnetic tape, made radio programs where we still had reel-to-reel tape recorders, and the phenomenon in Danish of tape salad when things went wrong and you had a whole load of tape on the floor. So most of us in the room are digital immigrants, but we live with digital natives, and there are still analog natives around. So the transition from the 20th to the 21st century was all about this shift, certainly for the youngest generations, from analog to digital. And that's really shaped the kinds of things that they choose to use. But the interesting question I wanted to raise is, what is changing and how fast does change happen? Because that's not immaterial if you're running a media business these days. These are figures from Denmark about household ownership of different kinds of gizmos, of bits of electronics. I would imagine they're very similar to the numbers in Hong Kong. If you look at it, some of the lines are going upwards, but some of them are going downwards. If you look at the red line, can you see that? It's a fixed line phones. They've gone from about 80% of households to less than 50% of households in the space of 10 years. Other things that have gone down are actually digital cameras. If you look at the dark blue line, and that's a bit misleading because it doesn't mean we're not using digital cameras anymore. It just means that digital cameras have become ubiquitous. We don't necessarily go out and use a separate device. We just pull out our smartphone and use the digital camera in that because it's probably almost as good as most of the other ones. And PCs, yeah, that's interesting. The last couple of years, sale of PCs has been eclipsed by the sale of tablets. And I would think that smartphones in many ways contain the same kind of processing power that a PC had 10 years ago. So the things we tend to take for granted may in fact change. Certainly, having been following the discussions about whether a fourth channel or a fourth system could actually get a license for digital terrestrial broadcasting in Hong Kong, it was interesting to see the arguments made by the government here that there wasn't really enough in advertising revenue for a fourth incumbent. I'm not quite sure that the arguments are that convincing, but certainly a lot has been happening in this field too. These are the numbers for Denmark, and remember, Denmark's slightly smaller than Hong Kong, but I think that the turnover figures must be broadly comparable. If you look at TV, which is the red line, it was hit quite severely by the economic downturn in 2008. But it's been climbing ever since 2009, so that's recovered quite nicely. And internet has shown double-digit growth and overtook television advertising in terms of its revenues in 2008. The media which have been hit seriously are things like the daily newspapers. That's the purple line. And magazines too, their advertising revenues have been declining. Other things are more or less stable. So, if you're into digital media and if advertising is one of the revenue streams you're interested in, you've really got to keep an eye out on the changes that are taking place in this field. A fourth area which is changing is the impact of demographics. If you take my generation, ancient people over the age of 60, we still tend to watch television, we still tend to listen to radio and to read things. That's the light blue columns on the right. Don't use mobile so much, and if we use it, we tend to use it for making phone calls. That's for all the people in the demographic. In my case, I do in fact use WeChat and QQ and things like that on my mobile phone, but that's perhaps a bit of a rarity. But if you compare the light blue columns with the dark blue ones, that's to say the young demographic, the 12 to 24-year-olds, you can see that they use the internet far more than anything else. We're looking now at the daily consumption measured in minutes. So for them, it's the internet. They may still watch TV, and that tends to be with their mates, with their friends, if there's something important, but it's not really part of their agenda anymore. And the mobile comes in at a close third, and they don't really read or listen to radio. They've got Spotify and things like that. And the reading thing is perhaps just a small diversion. Yesterday we had the results for the PISA rankings, and it seems that Shanghai is top of the pile these days. Well, I think one of the challenges we have in many countries, certainly in Asia, but perhaps also in Europe, is doing something about the interest in reading for pleasure. And a number of young people seem to feel that they have to work so hard and study so hard that they actually lose interest in reading per se. And that's a bit of a shame, because until fairly recently, this is one of the strongest indicators of career success, your interest in reading. And this business about of demographics is an interesting one. I mentioned that the elderly elders, I use a neutral term, a political term. Elders tend to watch TV. Young people tend to watch some of the same kind of content, but on other devices. But it's interesting that in the UK, with a population of 60 million, one in six of the population has never ever used the internet, and they tend to be people over the age of 60, and predominantly women. It's for every man in that age group who hasn't used the internet are two women. The number is actually getting better. So from 2010 to 2013, there was a significant improvement. And in 2012, a million adults used the internet for the first time in the UK as part of a number of campaigns, which we could call digital literacy campaigns. But if we look at probably the most interesting market worldwide for things like online video or video on demand, that's the Chinese one. This is a TV series that launched about 2 weeks ago in China. The English name is The Goddess Office, and if you type in that link, you can see the trailer. It's quite interesting that the format, the conceptually, it's based on something that stems from Europe, and they've just taken a format and done a Chinese wraparound. But it's going to be interesting to see how that is viewed. But this is not designed primarily for viewing on TV. It's actually designed primarily for the very substantial viewership on the internet. And the reason for this, it's a bit small, but you'll get this afterwards, is simply because in many countries, television is still regarded as a potentially risky medium, and therefore something that merits government control. It's not just in China, it's also in the West. Whereas the internet is regarded as being something that there aren't all that many people using it, are there? So therefore, when it comes to content on the internet, we don't really have to worry too much. So the self-same series broadcast on television may be subject to quite significant editorial control by a government agency, whereas there isn't hardly any control on the internet, with the exception of things like porn and so on. The big problem here, it seems to be, you move the content from one platform to another, but the incumbents, those who actually working on this. The top three I've listed there. These are figures from the Economist and a Chinese source. They've got a huge amount of traffic. They've got a fair amount of advertising revenue. It's around, I think it's eight billion renminbi a year now, just for the top two here. But they're losing money. Why? That's because there aren't any economies of scale. When you increase your audience, you're going to have a better infrastructure, and they're paying a small fortune to two of the bandwidth sellers in China to be able to deliver these streams to their users. So unlike broadcast, whether you've got one viewer or 100 million viewers, you've essentially got the same costs. When it's streaming services, then you've got costs which are broadly increasing as a function of the number of simultaneous users. It's also perhaps an indication that the technologists never managed to get us to use multicast. We're doing unicast, which is completely crazy because most of the people looking at these things are all seeing exactly the same things at the same time. So the first bit of my talk is the main takeaways that I think we need to recognize that the technologies, the underlying technologies, change and will continue to change. The second point is that our society is diverse, and from an IT perspective, it consists of analog natives, and digital immigrants, and digital natives. And the remaining analog natives will become fewer and fewer as they pass on. But even so, it's going to take a while for all those digital natives to become as savvy as the young generation. But from a media organization perspective, one of the comforting things is that as human beings, we all share broadly the same basic needs. But they may actually get satisfied in different ways. So as long as we understand what makes people tick, we can actually do quite a reasonable job. There's a typo there, sorry. So ultimately, it's a question of having a sense of what's changing and the rate of change. These are two of the critical things when it comes to our strategic thinking. So that's a bit about the background, the context for talking about apps. If we look at apps, what do we mean by it? Well, it's just a short term for application software. Frequently it's used these days to mean a mobile app. And in some cases, people with more technical background will continue to talk about a computer program. So if you turn on the television and look at a program, you'll probably find people using app in this narrow sense, something which is designed to be used on a handheld device, whether it be a smartphone or a tablet. But we often talk about social media when we talk about these things, and what does that mean? So just to make it a bit clearer, there's no doubt about the fact that this dialogue between two of my grandkids is just that. It's a kind of social intercourse. They're talking, in fact, in this particular case, they're talking about being a pirate, because Daniel is very much into patches over one eye and a plastic sword and going around pretending to be a pirate. But my eldest granddaughter is very much into using her mobile phone. So when she's speaking to her grandma, she'll probably be speaking on the phone, whereas with everybody else, she'll be chatting or even using a text message on occasion, although that's so yesteryear as far as she's concerned. If we look at the mainstay of what we used to do, it was the printed word and books. From one perspective, we could say that we had a kind of asynchronous communication in the past when we wrote something, put it in a library, and somebody else came along and took it out from the library. And then we have things like sharing photos. There's a pop group in my part of the world called One Direction, and a lot of young people, not just young girls, seem to be completely crazy about this particular group. But mind you, when I was at that age, I was probably quite keen on the Beatles, so there's nothing fundamentally different about it all. So when we're talking about social media, we have to think about the synchronous and asynchronous dimension, whether we're actually communicating like what you're listening to me as the audience and me speaking, or if it's asynchronous, where when we're doing something and the communication takes place not in real time but over a period of time. And the other dimension we need to think about is it presential or virtual? Does it require us to be in the same place, or can we be in different places? And that leads to a very simple taxonomy for what we're doing of synchronous same place communication. So when we're having a discussion, when we're going to a lecture, that's essentially a kind of social exchange in the same room. But last night I had to give a talk to some people in Croatia. And we started at 10 p.m. In that particular case, it was synchronous, but definitely not the same place. And there was a huge separation, so I finished just before midnight and did both the presentation and the Q&A. But that was with a whole group of broadcasters in the southeast of Europe discussing barrier-free television or accessible television. And asynchronous, the same place. I mean, that's the library scenario. You put a book in the library and you take it out again. And the advantage of going digital for libraries, as Negroponte said, is when you take a bit, there's still a bit left. So when you put things in on a website, or if you want to have a repository with a PDF in it, when you take a PDF, it doesn't mean it's disappeared. You've just taken essentially a copy. And then we've got asynchronous virtual communication. That's things like email. And last night, when my wife wasn't where she should have been, when I had to speak to her on Skype, and she's in Argentina, so I just recorded a brief video message so she could pick it up when she came back along. I think there are different views on what constitutes virtual, what constitutes social intercourse, what's truly social, and I think a number of you have seen this. Do you have Facebook? No. How about Twitter? No. Do you have WhatsApp? No. Then what do you have? A life. So it's, I think, certainly for my granddaughters, they find it hard to envisage a life without messaging and chat programs and all these other things. But in fact, human beings have done quite nicely for thousands of years without these gizmos. So in principle, it can be done. It may be rather more difficult, but life doesn't necessarily have to involve social media. And I think that's probably a good example of social media. So you've got a number of people all sitting there interacting with a device, but also interacting with each other, talking, analysing, enjoying things together. So social in the context of apps originally meant communication at the same time and place, but now social covers virtual communication. So when designing social media, we need to keep in mind time and place. Maybe self-evident, but when it comes to designing things, we don't always factor these things in properly. So this talk is about second screen apps and what are they. That's my elder granddaughter again. A typical scenario used to be that you would chill out on the sofa after a tough day in the absence of anything more intelligent to do and watch the box. But these days, that's a more typical scenario. You wouldn't necessarily be using your remote. You might actually be interacting with another screen using your mobile phone or your computer tablet. So it's all about using different kinds of devices together. Here's an example of something that one of my students in Denmark is interested in. You're using your smartphone as a games controller, and you're interacting with something on a bigger screen, and it's doing this with Wi-Fi. He went on to do a kind of warm-up activity when people go to the cinema. These days, Danish cinemas normally remind you politely to turn off your wretched phone. But in this particular cinema, you're encouraged to turn it on and interact during the commercials before the film starts. And he's designed an activity which allows, in particular, a younger demographic to interact with various things before the film per se starts. So from a sociological perspective, it's interesting to note that in a number of samples around the world, about 7 in 10 viewers of television, this is typical advertising speak, 7 in 10 enhance TV by simultaneously using another device. It may be a laptop, it may be an iPad, or it may be a smartphone. And the people who are into this at the moment tend to be male. The 895 is just a term from this particular thing, but college educated people who tend to have an incessant use of social media. Significantly more likely than average to socialise content about entertainment, and this kind of behaviour is highest in countries like India, Brazil, and China. Some of the so-called BRICS, with the absence of Russia, because they're not quite so into it yet. So that's the what we're talking about when we're talking about second screen apps. And if we look at what is actually allowing us to do, I mean, we've had things like voting using SMS. Remember Supergirl and Superboy a few years ago in the mainland during the school holidays. It was a big success, certainly with the school kids. I don't think it's quite such a success with the authorities in Beijing, who found a reason for making sure it didn't continue, even though it had an audience of somewhere between 250 to as much as 400 million when it was being aired. But taking part in things synchronously. And what they're going to be doing for this, the series that you can see up there, is that you can actually quiz the main characters. You can actually send money, because I don't know if it's real money or virtual money, because the four main characters are all working on e-commerce and setting up different kinds of e-commerce businesses. In fact, Paul, it might be interesting to analyse this as part of the ICOM program, to see if there's anything that we could use to jazz up the program with.
You mean come to lecture and watch TV?
Well, the main characters in this thing are putting together their own businesses. So it's interesting, and they're encountering all kinds of difficulties. I haven't seen more than the trailer. I've just read about it. In fact, in The Economist, which had a long article about exactly this particular series. So you can, things that need to be synchronous are things like, people want to interact when something's showing, but it could also be more conventional things, breaking news, sports results. If you're a bit disappointed about the lecture and want to know what's happening down the road at Happy Valley, you might want to know if your favourite horse, how that's actually doing in a particular race. Certainly for those interested in public service, if you're interested in making your content accessible, maybe you're interested in the accessibility dimension, offering subtitles, closed captioning, or sign language, or some kind of description. And what we do know is that those who don't have disabilities tend to get rather upset about being forced to have, for example, sign language covering part of the picture. So what we're looking to do is to be able to offer these services in an opt-in, opt-out fashion, an optional fashion. And what we can do is actually use a combination of broadcast and broadband to deliver some of these things in a non-intrusive manner. In terms of asynchronous video on demand, the TV series I showed you, the Chinese one, you can see it when it's aired, but you can see it when you want to as well. You can use it to actually find something different. So I've just used the label meta content. Just a label for content about content. It could be a program listing. It could be spots or trailers. It could, for that matter, be more conventional adverts or recommendations, information services linked to the show. These could both be what I would regard as positive, or it could be somewhat more dubious, you know, product placement for various kinds of things. So if we're looking at the synchronous part of these second screen apps, what we're looking to do, if it's got to be reasonably synchronous, is looking at some sort of mechanism to ensure that what you see is broadly in sync within, say, a second or so with what you're seeing on your small screen, whether it's a smartphone or a tablet. We'll come back to that. One of the things that struck me when I saw the trailer for that Chinese TV series is that you've got subtitles, and as it's being delivered digitally, there's no reason why you couldn't just have that as a closed captioning, as to say, an opt-in solution. And the Chinese have an additional problem because their digital TV standard had to keep things as cheap and cheerful as possible when they actually decided on the standards more than 6 years ago. And that means the standard in its current form doesn't actually have a provision for closed captioning. And it doesn't have a provision for some of the other access services. So if you want to do it, it's rather difficult because you can, in fact, change the standard. But you've got an installed base, a whole load of TV sets that are using the original digital TV standards. So certainly in rural China, this constitutes a challenge, at least. But if you look at the kinds of TVs being sold these days in the mainland, they tend to be hybrids. That's to say, they can handle a broadcast signal, but they can also handle the internet, typically with Wi-Fi. And that means if you've got something like that coming in, you can deliver some of these things either completely using the internet layer, the IP layer, or you can do an overlay by putting the subtitles or some of the other services on after the event. And certainly if you've got a wide format, it looks reasonably okay to visually have the subtitles at the bottom in a black band, and it's also more legible to do it in that way. So when we're talking about second screen, the main screen is typically going to be a cinema, or a television screen, or even a PC screen. And then what we're doing is just using a second screen in much the same way as we used to use a remote. And I've got an additional box there with a dotted line around it, performing arts. If you go to the opera in Barcelona, so for that matter, if you go to see a theatrical play, they actually ask you when you come into the theatre to turn on your mobile phone. And that's because they've discovered it's a lot cheaper to deliver closed captioning and audio description onto people's mobile phones. They can actually do something smart to make sure you don't use it for a phone call, but they're actually using these individual displays so that those who need to hear the audio description because they're blind, or those who go to see an opera in Italian whose command of Italian isn't particularly good, they may actually benefit from seeing a translation in one or a number of different languages. And these are just displayed on your mobile phone, on your smartphone. And that's been running now for about 3 years.
Do they need a special app to do that?
I don't actually know. I think it's a free app that you can download in the foyer of the theatre. That's it. I can find out for you. One of the people I met in September who does research in this kind of thing suggested this basic taxonomy to look at apps. So if you look at the horizontal axis, on the left-hand side, it's low interactivity and high interactivity. So something which is tightly knitted to the television itself. And then synchronization, the extent to which something actually needs to be really synchronous with the what's going on the main screen. And the vertical axis, the top, is something which is highly synchronous, and something at the bottom is low synchronous. And that gives us four main areas for talking about apps, and that actually works for apps in general. So if we take the light blue box on the bottom right, that will be many of the apps we're used to seeing on our phones or on our computer tablets. But on the top left, for example, that would be something like the subtitling or audio description or sign language. And companion app would be something that might be going on in connection with a soap opera, a drama where you're interacting with that, or it may be some sort of quiz format, the weakest link or one of these other things. And the baseline information app is something which is just background information, which it doesn't need to be at all synchronous. So that can be used in general for apps, not just for second screen apps, but it's a basic framework to conceptualize what we're talking about. So if we look at the whole business of designing things, I think there are at least two main schools of thought. There's a sort of highly analytical approach. You do all your market research and so on the basis of which you then go out and try and put together some sort of experience or whatever. And then there's a sort of action-centric model which looks at design from an iterative, agile perspective, which of course makes use of an evidence-based approach, what we already know, but it actually allows us to think on our feet. And let's just say we actually accept that good designers have some qualities that may be difficult to put down on paper. I used to be a sort of a rational kind of person and thought this is a load of rubbish, but I've actually over the last 40 years come to recognize that maybe we need to find a mechanism that actually incorporates the things which we may find difficult to explain in a rational context. Somebody who's worked in media for many years does in fact have a huge experience about what works and what doesn't, and it makes sense to encourage them to work in a more systematic, iterative fashion to test their implicit hypothesis rather than trying to do everything just by market research. And it's quite useful to look at people's motivations for using these things. Some of my colleagues at Murdoch University in Perth, it's in fact the same clan as Rupert Murdoch's, but no direct relationship to the current incumbent of that name. I think we used to think that people's motivations for using things like apps is predominantly sort of information seeking, but the research we have indicates is often far broader. That's also a dimension, but it's often social motivations. There's a paper about this, which is a few years old, but it's still valid. They looked at some of the motivations for using the media, and the ones in red are the ones which I think are the areas where second screen apps could actually be of interest. So sensory gratification, intellectual stimulation and mastery, social approval. Okay, this is an academic writing about things, but even so, it's on occasions quite useful to have a look at some other people's perspectives on what works and what doesn't. From a more sociological perspective, it's interesting to look at value and engagement in social entertainment and second screens. And if you're interested in it, you can download the whole report. It's a free one from a company called Edelman. One of the things they did about 18 months ago was looking at what people do when for example, watching TV or doing something else. They're quite often interacting with others. And at the time they did this study, and I'm pretty sure it's changed, much of the interaction took place before a particular media experience, before watching a program, before going to the cinema, before going to a show. So sussing out, looking at what is likely to happen in that experience. But there's a significant proportion who actually do things during the event itself, during the program. And these are the proportion of the whole of the UK population who interact. So when we're talking about at least one in six who are interacting before or during a program, and afterwards, one in three are actually going to get fired up and actually write something on Facebook or somewhere else or on Twitter about what they've just experienced. So it's of course dangerous to overgeneralize, but it's interesting that such a relatively high proportion of the population are doing that. I would hazard a guess that if you take the people in China who've got an internet connection, the figures are probably going to be higher than that. Then a recent study, one from this year from the same organisation, talked about what people say they want. I've highlighted the word say because what people say and what they actually do are not necessarily synonymous. That's the importance of triangulating your studies, because people come along and say, would you be interested in X, Y, and Z? And most people are quite polite, and they'll tend to perhaps say yes, even if they don't actually agree. So you may need to check your data with another method, another source, to see if they actually correlate. But what people say when you ask them is that they're interested in immersive and interactive experiences, and And the reason for looking at that Chinese soap opera was that it's an example of the kind of thing that I think would be interesting to a younger demographic. I can't really honestly see them watching some of the CCTV, say the documentary channel, all that much. I'm sure there are people who do, but I think they're more likely to be interested in what I would call light entertainment than something of an overtly educational nature. And the figures from the study this year indicate that you're as likely to share in your feelings and impressions of entertainment as your information about yourself and your families. So it's one of the things that you actually do the most when it comes to social interaction. And the leaders in this area are India, Brazil, China, and Turkey. So these trends are more widespread in these countries than in Europe and the US. The other thing to keep in mind is that we like to share good things. We're a bit more reticent about sharing negative experiences. You've been to a show and it was awful. You don't necessarily want to admit that you'd actually parted with good money to go and see something which was rather poor. But on the other hand, if you had a good time, it's five times more likely you want to actually share the fact you had a good time with your friends and family. Okay, it's not everybody. It's only one in five, but that's still a significant number. So some of you in the room actually work with media, and the real flagships when it comes to media tend to be events. You may remember what an impact the Beijing Olympic Games had. In fact, the Olympic Games last year in London, which was in many ways a very joyous activity. It seemed to be a way of actually getting the Brits involved and actually coming out of their shells and actually trying to be reasonable hosts to the many people who swamped London with their presence. At a conference in September in Amsterdam, we discussed some of these things. We looked at Super Bowl, we looked at London 2012, we also looked at a talent show like The X Factor. And I won't bore you with the details, but there were presentations from these three specialists. And it's in particular Sarah Pearson who was talking about video ethnography, actually using qualitative survey methods to get a sense of what makes people tick, not just as individuals, but in their own family or peer environments. And Regina Bernhaupt is the sort of the rigorous person who actually moves forward and provides some very good models for actually analysing what's going on and seeing how that can help us plough the findings back into what we're doing when it comes to media work. And Les Carter was talking about second screen and advertising. And That's a discipline in its own right. What we need to keep in mind is that we're living in a multi-platform world. In the past, we may have had a limited number of devices, a TV, a radio, and so on. But these days, we have, if you're delivering TV, we've got multiple devices. If you've got a company, an organisation like the BBC, they're delivering on approximately 900 different kinds of devices using their iPlayer. So broadcast and IP-based networks and mobile networks onto a range of devices like television sets and computers and tablets and the Xbox and Nintendo Wii. On all these devices, you can actually make use of on-demand content. and therefore it's quite important to have a sense of what are we talking about in terms of diurnal rhythms, or what time of the day are various platforms important. If you've got to do some load balancing, it's quite important to see what's going to be happening to your mobile network if they're all going to be using it at the same time. For a portal player or an embedded player, you can see that it tends to be something even in working hours, and it builds up. In this case, it's Holland. There's suddenly a little surge upwards just before people leave work and go home. They're often checking out various things they want to do in the evening, and the peak viewing periods on these things tend to be at least an hour later than they would be on conventional, traditional platforms like broadcast television. So what we also need to keep in mind is the fact that as we've got the mantra of the four or five C's, you know, convenience, control, choice, customization, the phenomenon of the long tail, if it's important to you, you don't really want to be tied to a particular broadcast schedule. You want to be able to do something when it's convenient to you and not when it's convenient to the scheduler of the content. And it's often quite important to be able to do that so that the day after you can actually discuss it with your friends around the water cooler. The methodological bits, this is mainly for the students, but maybe for others. In the past, many of the technologies required a paradigm where you had to be able to turn things on and off. So in this particular TV set, you had five television channels, and you just pressed a button at the bottom of the screen to go from TVB to ATV, whether it's in English or in Cantonese. Okay, I put a fifth one in there, so Ricky Wong could in fact have at least one channel. But the paradigm for my parents' generation and my grandparents was an on-off mechanism. You turn things just by pressing buttons. But the problem is that we've moved on, and we've now got a point-and-click paradigm, or even a finger movements. And for some people, this is tricky. Not so much the moving your finger across a screen. I've got a number of research students in Denmark have been doing their master's dissertations, and it's quite intriguing. People in their 80s who've never used a computer actually learn to use a tablet faster than a conventional PC. They're a bit intimidated by the whole business of holding a mouse and coordinating their hand movements with what they see on the screen, whereas Apple and the others have broadly got the basics okay by using your fingers to go forwards and backwards and perhaps enlarging things or reducing things, zooming in and zooming out. These are conventions which can be learnt by an elder in the space of an hour or two, whereas a mouse, learning to use a mouse may in fact take a whole day if you've never ever done it and you're in your late 60s or in your 70s. This is a significant challenge to learn these conventions that the rest of us have almost been brought up with. So second screen apps for selecting content seem to be on the way forward for media companies. That's my younger daughter actually doing this. And if you want to read more about it, I was asked to write a short article for RTHK. So if you have a look, you can see a background article covering much the same content as I'm doing here. And again, for the people interested in this, Regina produced a very good paper on some of the research methods that can be useful for analysing what people actually do when they're working with media. So she's got essentially six different kinds of tasks and some subcategories. And what she actually does when she's observing is to do this kind of annotation to break down what goes on in a kind of tree structure, and to identify where there are significant cognitive challenges for different kinds of users, not just elderly but also young people. So from a methodological perspective, there's something quite useful there. And if you can't get hold of the paper, let me know and I can provide you informally with a copy of it. So where do we go from here? By this time next year, we will have international standards, probably global standards, using things like Hybridcast or HBBTV. These are not tied into particular digital TV standards, but they're simply mechanisms that allow us to provide integrated broadcast broadband solutions. So if it makes sense to distribute the same program to everybody, clearly a broadcast signal is a very cost-effective way of doing it. If, on the other hand, we want to customize, we want to do things which are targeting a small subset, then it makes a lot of sense to deliver that kind of content using the internet and to combine the two on the same screen. Now, you could do that on a one-screen setup, and you can also do it on a two-screen setup. If you're doing it on a two-screen setup, then the issue arises, how are we going to make sure that the stuff that's being broadcast is broadly in sync with the stuff which uses packets, you know, and an IP layer? That's always going to be a difficulty, because IP systems are typically best effort. It's a bit like sending your parcels to a relative in Vancouver. The parcels actually might go all sorts of different routes, and do you want to gather them all together before handing them out for Christmas, or if it's a presents for the Chinese New Year? But what we've got, it seems to be international standards which actually work both with the internet and the five major TV systems, which provide a good robust mechanism for synchronizing things. And that's also because increasingly there's fairly big buffers. So if nothing else, you can actually delay everything, so it's all synchronous until you've caught up with those packets that have got rerouted somewhere else. So I think if we meet in a couple of years' time, I'm pretty sure that in some markets where television is still an important social phenomenon, and this is clearly in countries with a significant number of persons over the age of 60. So Korea, 32% of the population is over 60. Japan at 27-28% is that age. Even in Denmark, the people in my generation, we're a force to be reckoned with, in also politically, because in numerical terms, well, there are so many of us that the political parties actually have to take us a bit more seriously than they used to. For a change, there's something where you're being taken seriously. So that was my attempt just to give you a sense of what's happening. This isn't the be-all and end-all. I don't think that second screen apps are going to be the only thing, but they're an interesting way of actually making a number of the more conventional media a bit more interesting, certainly to demographics that have voted with their feet and essentially dropped, say, broadcast television. So the key takeaway, I think, is that smartphones and tablets are now truly ubiquitous. We really need to get a good understanding of what makes people tick, what their social motivations are, so that we can actually come up with media that makes sense. And we don't want to get into awkward situations by just using one method. We think it's going to be very important to triangulate, to get a variety of different inputs, so we can patch together a clearer idea of what's going on when it comes to people's use of media. And as I said, my personal opinion is certainly for public broadcasters, and possibly for the entertainment industry, apps and second screen apps are set to play a role in stimulating mass media and the performing arts. That's it. And if you need to get hold of me, that's my contact information. Thank you very much.